If you want to get your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. Gizmo Sapiens.
Hey, welcome to the Gizmo Sapiens Show 132. I'm Chris, and with me today is
Matt.
And we're going to talk to you about a few things that are dear to our heart, and hopefully they will be interesting to you as well, our listeners. So I think the first big thing we'll talk about is space, the final frontier. So we'll not only talk about SpaceX and Boeing, but we'll also talk about upcoming Star Trek.
Okay. I think we can do that.
So what's been interesting is SpaceX has done their Dragon crew flight. They did the solo flight to the space station, successfully docked and transferred. It stayed up there for several days, and then they brought it home. Then they had an issue on the launch pad and lost one of the modules. So now their next flight, which was supposed to be, I think, in July with an actual crew, is now pushed off until September. I don't think it's a big deal. It would have been a big deal if there were people on it, but that's why they do all this testing. And they probably found an anomaly that's correctable, and they will get that going. But Boeing still has not put their first, just the test flight for their crewed system. They call it the Starliner, is what Boeing calls it. It was supposed to happen in I think it was supposed to happen not long after SpaceX. Now it's pushed to August. But evidently its first mission will actually last for a couple months. It won't be there for just a few days.
Interesting.
Yeah. But then on top of that, you have the SpaceX just put up the first reused Heavy Falcon with 24 different payloads to be delivered in three different orbits for various federal government agencies, including the new atomic clock that NASA put up in space, so that we have a new master timekeeper, I guess. Does that mean that we're going to start going to space for our time sync instead of the Naval Observatory atomic clock?
Can only assume that's...
I don't know, but...
what that means.
It was a big deal because there's an Air Force mission. While it's not a classified mission, it's supposed to be the precursor to SpaceX using the Heavy Falcons to launch some billion-dollar payloads instead of million-dollar payloads for the Air Force. So that was interesting. What else has been going on?
Going back to the Boeing thing for a minute, mm-hmm. Or rather, SpaceX failure. Interesting that the turnaround between failure and next attempt is measured in months rather than years.
Years, absolutely.
That's, I think, that's private industry versus a government agency.
Well, yeah. Well, it's also the ability, because they're so nimble, too. They don't have to worry about budget cycles to go back. You know, I had this much in my budget that Congress gave me to do this launch, and it failed. And well, now I've got to put that back in the budget so I can do it again.
Yeah.
You know.
Now, that's not to say that there isn't an impact on SpaceX. I'm sure they don't have a money tree in Elon's backyard that they keep going to, but I think it's probably less of an impact than, say, NASA.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I just go back and I...
Well, you got to imagine, too, this has to be insured for... You know.
Yeah.
as well. So, you know, NASA doesn't usually have insurance, I guess. They're uninsurable. Because they can only pay their premiums one time a year. And
yeah.
If it's outside of that, there's no changing their coverage. But it is interesting. I think SpaceX would have turned around and done it next month. But I think it's probably NASA wanting to go through all of the telemetry and log data to see if they agree with what the issue was.
Agreed. But I thought that was an interesting, because let's face it, if this was a NASA mission using NASA assets.
Well, look at the Columbia.
A failure. Well, that's what I was getting at.
Look at the Columbia. Look at the.
It took them how many years to go through all of that, and
or the Challenger even.
Well, precisely. You know, every time they've had, you can even go back to Apollo 1. Really, every time they've had a failure. Now, the difference between those three events and the one we're talking about is loss of life.
Yeah.
If they were to lose a Dragon with
people on it,
crew, that would, I would think it would take a little more time to figure out and reassure and reassess that they've got the problem fixed. But even looking at some of the rocket failures that NASA put up that were just, you know, payload rockets, not human spaceflight rockets.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to go back, but I would think even those systems take longer to reassess and reevaluate than what we're seeing here.
Yeah. Well, you know, the issue is that we're starting to see an era where we're doing a lot more launches. You know, let's go back to the beginning of the space program. If you really look at the number of launches we made in the 60s and 70s, you can count them on two hands and all your toes. From 80 to today, well, from 80 till 2000, you know, you're probably talking a few hundred launches, you know, when you take into all the satellites and stuff that were put up. And then you go from 2000 to today, and you're talking about many, many, many. I don't know that it's in the thousands of launches that have happened, but in the hundreds of launches by far, because by 2000, you then had ESA launching their own rockets and the Indian Space Agency launching their own rockets and South Africa launching their own rockets and stuff. and even SpaceX took it to the next level. And, you know, we're not doing, even if we did a launch a month with NASA, that's only 12 launches a year. SpaceX is doing, you know, tons of launches per month by themselves. And it's just like when we first had motor cars. If you're the only one driving a car, you know, the chances of you getting in an accident or something going wrong that would cause a fatality is getting lower. But the reality of it is if we continue to increase the number of launches that we have to do things, the greater the chance of fatalities and other things are going to happen. And unfortunately, unlike driving a car, that area, that piece of time between when they take off from the launch pad until they can get outside of the stratosphere, there's probably not much you can do from a recovery point if something goes wrong.
Well, that's one of the things that even NASA had to deal with. I mean, once you light the candle, there's no, you're talking about recovery rather than rescue.
But, I mean, think about this even. Say you got the technology down to where there's only a 1% chance of it having a catastrophic failure and killing someone.
But that means 1 in 100, and you're already talking about 100 plus launches a year.
Exactly.
And what happens if that 1 in 100 happens in your first 10 launches? Then it appears that it's 10%.
Yeah. Well,
you know.
Math is hard.
It is. It is. But I do think it's interesting. I mean, that, you know, wasn't alive back then, neither were you. But the initial space launches back in the Kennedy era, I think were probably pretty exciting. But I actually think what's going on right now is probably even more exciting. If you're into it. And that's the problem, is I don't think there's that many people into it because they've become kind of immune because or they don't like to think about it because we've probably the people alive today have probably lived through more catastrophes, particularly with Challenger and Columbia, than they did back in the 60s and 70s. I mean, we did have some loss of life. You know, we had a rocket blow up on the launch pad, had a capsule with astronauts in it catch fire. But that wasn't the
norm.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard it said that part of why Apollo ended, some would even say prematurely, was that by Apollo 17, you'd had 7 successful missions. It became, well, I mean, 13 was a successful failure, but there was no drama there left.
Yes.
Which I put that on the fact that you're talking about a scientific and engineering endeavor. What you don't want in either of those cases is drama, and that's, you know, not what sells.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, there were other things going on too. As we get into the 70s, well, the late 60s and early 70s, we start getting into the fuel crisis, and that's where people's attention were, and, you know, the end of the Vietnam War and people coming home, and so that, I think, you know, those things that happen were drawing attention away from the space program, the excitement. You know, where as the space program, in a large part, particularly in the mid to late 60s, drew away attention from what was going on in the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
You know?
I'd agree with that.
But the other thing that went on too is you had Russia and everything that they were doing. I mean, as much as we were, you know, in the Cold War with them, they really did a lot to advance space travel and rocketry, particularly between when the Apollo program ended and the early 2000s. You know, the whole Soyuz rocket system that unfortunately they're still using today and hasn't, you know, they stagnated for it. They developed it, and it's become very, very reliable. But that being said, it's only reliable today based upon how many explosions and, you know, catastrophic explosions they had testing those rockets and trying to send them into space.
Well, I mean, the road forward is always paved by the road behind you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the nature of the business.
Yeah. Very true. Very true. So one of the other more controversial things that I want to talk about NASA is you put this on your Facebook a lot about, you know, War on Women update. But there was an interesting article from Wired,
okay,
about how NASA failed female astronauts and built space travel for men. And it's a good read,
okay,
because
although we've had female astronauts, particularly who were main crew members, and even I think there's a couple who were commanders of space shuttle missions, we never sent a woman to the moon.
Well, I think part of that was a...
Part of it was cultural at the time.
Let's admit, yeah. This was a different time. Can you imagine sending a woman to the moon and she died?
Yeah.
It's one thing to send a man up there for that. At that time?
Oh, yeah. No, I...
That would have been the end of manned... Manned. Space flight altogether. I don't... That we managed to...
Well, if a man at the time culturally, if a man had gone to the moon and died, he would have been considered a hero. If a woman had gone to the moon and died, it wouldn't have been about the woman. It'd have been about the men who. Why did those men send a woman to the moon and she have her die?
It would have been a tragedy.
Yeah.
Not that the man going wouldn't have been, but it would be viewed as a tragedy, and that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have a space program at all, which we don't really.
Well,
we do, but we don't.
Yeah. Our the biggest mistake that happened is that in between Apollo and now, is that we didn't let commercial spaceflight take off.
Well, I think there are plenty of reasons why that is. Do you have any?
I don't. Culturally, it kind of goes against what we do typically.
Part of it, I think, is NASA was so successful in winning the space race the first time that I think for the longest time there was a thought that really NASA was the only organization that could really do it.
I kind of agree with you. I think part of it, too, was also application. Because other than weather satellites...
Why go?
Why did we need to send anything up?
Well,
you know, spy satellites, whether things that the government would control anyway.
Right.
And then we hit the early 80s and we start putting up the first radio telecommunication satellites and cell phone satellites and those types of things. And then all of a sudden the commercial industry is interested because now there's a market for commercial space flight. The problem I see with it is all of that started in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. And it's not until now, you know, it's taken like 30 years for it to develop. Now, I think part of that stumbling block was Challenger and Columbia.
But you also got to realize how much risk there is. And when you're talking a business, risk is not their business.
It is, but it isn't. I mean, with innovation, you have to have some risk.
Agreed, which is why I think, well, we can talk about the shuttle program and how that should have been mothballed.
Far sooner than it was.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, I love the shuttles. And there was nobody more sad than I when the time came. But let's face it, NASA did not do its job in maintaining the innovation.
Yeah. They hit Tang and they thought they were done.
Well, we'll go a little bit further than that. But yeah, I mean, the next thing never came.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, space stations, I mean, you can talk Skylab, you can talk International Space Station. But then what?
Yeah.
You know, this is where the whole Mars thing comes into play, and NASA was just either wasn't interested in it, couldn't fund it, or just lacked the skill of innovation to push it forward.
Yeah.
And let's face it, we as a culture had other things going on. So
I think to some degree all of that is correct. I think NASA, the problem, it's like a TV series that's run for way too many seasons. And so viewership just declines because people are kind of bored with the concept. That's what kind of happened to Apollo 17. Because we were putting astronauts and stuff and sending them out, but there wasn't any real mission to do. There wasn't anything exciting about what they were doing at that point. And when after Apollo 17, NASA was still doing a lot of space work, but it changed because we got a new set of scientists in there, starting with Carl Sagan. And, you know, they were focused on exploring the solar system. And it's not practical to send somebody in a rocket to explore the solar system. So it was putting satellites up in space and having them go on these long-term missions, you know, which would take 10 and 20 and 30 years before they were getting any meaningful data back. And people just couldn't keep their attention on that. And, you know, and NASA was becoming much more cerebral. They were becoming a much heavier scientific organization that wasn't really about space, but it was about
science. Yeah.
And so then you hit the 80s and we have the shuttle program, and it's kind of funny because the shuttle program relates directly back to Star Trek, because you had the Enterprise and they got the cast and Gene Roddenberry to kind of sponsor. Why? Because they were trying to get interest back in the program, you know, get people to, they built Space Camp, and remember the movie with Leah Thompson about Space Camp, and it's kind of funny because Space Camp is still cool. But one of my customers is down at Marshall Space Flight Center, and Space Camp sits off Marshall,
mm-hmm.
right next to a Marriott. And I used to stay at that Marriott all the time, and my room would overlook the Space Camp, and I just remember going, this looks so much cooler in the movie. And I say that every time I'm out there.
I'll bet.
But there was that, and that's what got the shuttle program going, but then it was hard to concentrate on the shuttle program.
Well, again, the same thing happened to the shuttle that happened to Apollo.
Well,
it got to the point, Challenger and Columbia aside.
Well, the thing is Columbia was Enterprise never flew. Columbia was the one that actually flew first missions, and Challenger was exciting because that was the first time they were bringing up a civilian as a mission specialist, you know, not somebody who was a former military or heavy scientist who, you know, and then it was kind of like NASCAR, you know, it blew up. Why do you watch NASCAR racing? It's not fun watching somebody turn left all the time, you know, until they crash or right.
I mean, that added drama, not the right kind of drama. I mean, loss of life is not the kind of drama that's going to continue programs that cost billions of dollars.
What's interesting about this article by Wired is the reason women haven't been more involved in a lot of these, like, spacewalks and things like that, is because NASA kind of stagnated the technology. You know, the spacesuits that they wear have not been changed in 40 years, if not longer.
Yeah, but that's not from a lack of trying, because I know NASA's still working on suit design and, yeah, but, and making changes.
But the other issue is that the suits that they're currently using that are on the International Space Station that are that they use to go up in the Soyuz are all designed for men. And NASA retired the smallest size. So the smallest size to wear is a medium.
That's right. I do remember hearing that.
And so, you know, these women who are highly qualified, you know,
can't fit in the suit.
Can't fit in the suit, so they
can't go.
You got it. And it, you know, and some of the interesting things. So one of the groups down at Houston.
So well, wait a minute though. Is that a NASA problem or is that a Russia problem? Because they're going up on the Russian rockets.
But they're wearing they're wearing American spacesuits.
Are they?
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if that was still the case.
And what's more interesting is so there's a group that does astronaut health for Mission Control at Johnson Space Center. And then in Cleveland at the Space Center there, NASA Space Center there, they have a group who does analysis of the astronaut health data. And you know that they had they've done the they're the ones who do all the comparisons on the Hadfield brothers, and it's kind of funny because it's a mixture of data scientists and like epidemiologists and doctors
mm-hmm.
who do all this work, so it's interesting to talk with them and hear what they have to say. But one of the things that they said and they've discovered is that really for a long-term space flight, women are much more suited than men.
That doesn't surprise
me. They don't have as much muscle mass to atrophy and lose.
Mm-hmm.
They don't because their genitals are internal, there's less of a chance of stray radiation, you know, causing birth defects or anything like that. I mean, there's just a list and goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
Not that men are going to stop going to space, but I think it just compounds the issue that you know, they haven't fixed an issue that is a known issue. Even if they were building the same designs, you know, they eliminated the one that fits some of the people who are more suited to the longer term space
yeah.
flights.
That's NASA for you.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, and you know, and going back to the other thing you said, budget was a big thing. You know, how many decades was NASA underfunded because they just weren't popular? You know?
Well, I don't know. I would have to see data on popularity, but
well, they
the problem is not always whether or not NASA's popular.
It's
or not
popular with people, but they weren't. What I mean is they weren't popular with the people setting the budgets. They weren't on the
yeah.
forefront of Congress. And,
but that's because yeah. of other world events happening
correct.
That took precedence.
I mean, you got the fall of the Berlin Wall, essentially the breakup of the USSR. I mean, all of those things happened during this formative period of our space program and, you know, and sucked a lot of things away from it. I mean,
what I think is probably the most impactful development was the fall of the USSR, and the only reason why I say that is because that was the chief competitor in the
space race. You got it.
You take them away, you put them off, take them off the table, and why are we spending billions of dollars sending these things up into space when we have kids to feed and clothe and
oh yeah,
you know, all the myriad domestic programs that...
Well, we have intelligence agencies we need to fund because now we have all of this, you know, all of these nuclear weapons in hands of people we don't... At least, you know, the kind of thing that was weird about the breakup of Russia was that it left the United States as the only superpower
mm-hmm.
For a long period of time. I would say China has filled in the gap to
yeah,
some degree.
Yeah, but they're kind of like the Diet Coke of superpowers.
You're right. No, I won't disagree with you there. But so what did it do? Well, now I don't have a competition that I need to fund against. But two, at least they were an enemy that we knew. Mm-hmm. You know, we knew the USSR. We knew what they were like. We had a good idea. But we didn't know what all these new independent countries were going to be. Some of them were going to be democratic and have a more capitalistic government. Some of them were probably going to be so socialist, you know, or despotic that we were going to have to watch them carefully. And so, you know, there was that period of time where they were funding tons of money into NSA and CIA and NGA. And actually, they were known as NRO at that time. But which, you know, that NRO didn't exist until somebody actually accidentally leaked their logo one day. I don't know. It's interesting to think about. It's interesting to see where it will go. You know, because definitely SpaceX and what's Jeff Bezos,
Blue Origin,
yeah, and a couple others are doing commercial space flight now. You know, they're putting satellites up for different industries. You know, the cell phone industry is huge. Satellite radio industry is huge. You know, they're always, because they're losing, the old satellites are dying, they have to put new ones up to make sure that they can maintain at least what they've got.
Yeah.
You know. So, it'll be interesting to see how it moves along. I every time I particularly see something about SpaceX and the Falcon Heavy rockets, because I just think their technology is so cool. If you look at what goes on at Johnson Space Center, when they launch a rocket, even if they launch it from Kennedy or Cape Canaveral, you know, at Mission Control there, and how many people and how many resources are there, and that rocket is a throwaway. And then SpaceX can, it's two guys sitting at a table with these massive, essentially gaming laptops, and they land the rocket on a barge in the middle of the sea.
Yeah. Yeah, that, to me, when I first heard that they were going to try that, right, this is not going to work. And for a while, it didn't.
Until it did.
Once, now it's like Apollo. It's yeah. The failure is news now rather than
the fact that it was, yeah,
that they were successful, that says a lot. And have they failed recently?
I mean, they actually, it wasn't a failure of the landing system, but the Falcon Heavy that just went up
had expended too much fuel,
and they couldn't because of weather, they couldn't land on land where they were supposed to land. So they tried to reroute to one of the landing platforms out to sea, and there wasn't enough fuel
to get there.
So it's just the main booster.
Well, to get to the point where that's considered a failure,
exactly,
is amazing to me, because it's still recoverable.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll reuse that.
Exactly.
You know, and that, to me, I can't imagine NASA doing that. I can't imagine NASA having the...
Well, if you recall, NASA said it couldn't be done.
Well, and that is why NASA fails.
Yeah.
It's a failure of imagination. It's a failure of innovation. And quite frankly, I don't understand why they have any say in it at all anymore.
I agree. Well, let's move on.
Okay.
I think this one... So, this is something that... it's not necessarily a technology problem, but it totally blows my mind that things like this can happen in a world where we have all this technology today. So we talk about the Dayton, Ohio area in West Dayton. They have an issue of an urban desert. And what they mean by that is that in their case, it's what's called a food desert. Mm-hmm. All the area grocery stores have closed, whether it's due to crime, lack of business, whatever. But there are huge areas where there is no easy way for people who live there to get
access to quality food.
Or other products.
Or other products. Well, now in Mississippi, Itabina, Mississippi.
Okay.
They are a banking desert. Their last bank closed a couple years ago. And I find it amazing, particularly since banking and fintech are such a big issue, but they can't get access to money at a reasonable cost because the only thing that's there is a, you know, they're a rural area with, you know, Itabina being the main city there, but evidently their ATM fees are like out of hand, and most of these people are not wealthy enough to really be able to embrace tech. So, you know, they're not using Venmo or PayPal or whatever to pay each other for goods and services. They still rely on cash.
Well, that's what I was just going to get to. At some point in this situation, not only are you going to become a cash society again, but wouldn't you consider returning to the barter system?
Yeah, but, you know, the problem with the barter system in today's society is I can't go to the county courthouse in Itabina and say, I'm going to pay my taxes with 6 chickens and 2 pigs.
Well, you could, but this is where I go back and say, without government,
yeah,
dot, dot, dot.
You're right.
You know, who would take care of these things? You know, I mean, that's... I would hope that the taxes would be so low there that, yeah, that would not be a problem.
Yeah, I would agree. But, you know, it's and that's actually an NBC News...
yeah, I saw that one too.
...article.
Setting it up. Like, oh,
but yeah. Evidently, there are 6,008 places where banks closed from 2008 to 2016 that are now considered banking deserts. And Itabina was just the one they
sure
gave a, as an example. It's the city has 1,828 people populating, and they say that's likely declining. There are 4 ATMs that sit inside the gas stations. Those ATMs charge $5.25 to $7.50 per transaction.
Wow.
Except for one.
And I get ticked off at the $2 they charge in town.
There is one no fee or low fee that's downtown.
Okay. How does that not have a line all the time?
And it does.
And constantly out of money.
It's constantly out of money. And that's the thing is people can't get cash. They can't get... and it says people who don't own a vehicle, $20 cash is the going rate to go to rides, to go to the next closest town.
Wow.
To go to the hospital, shops, banks, or full-service grocery stores. Because their town does not have a full-service grocery store either.
Well, and again, talking about the west side of Dayton.
Yeah.
You know, they're talking now that they've closed that hospital out that way.
Yeah, how do they get to service, you know, medical service when they need it? Yeah, they're in the process of tearing that one down, isn't it? Right there in Trotwood?
Yeah.
Let me see. There's something else in here that was... So they talk about the ripple effect. It was already a poor community with a shrinking population, but their unemployment rate is 31.4%, and their median household income is $21,792.
So, again, you're talking about a wide range of problems.
Yep.
Of which a banking desert
is
only a part of it.
Correct. Regions Bank, well, they're saying that the problem is that the bank, the reason the bank closed was because of those issues.
Right.
It costs them $200,000 a year, including rent, salaries, power, and building upkeep to keep a bank branch open. That's according to Regions Bank, who was the last bank who had a branch there and closed in 2017.
So let's get to the root causes of what is actually happening in this community. And I guarantee you, government will have some role in it.
Yeah.
Almost guaranteed.
Yep. Oh, very likely. I mean, the problem is you know, it's like a lot of very rural communities. And Mississippi as a state is, when we, for years, they've always been, and I don't agree with this metric, but in education, it was always Mississippi was number one, or the last state. They were number 50 in how much was spent per student, you know, in the state. Now, I don't think that number
matters
because maybe it's a lot cheaper to educate people at the same level in Mississippi than it is in the state of New York. You know, cost of living is different. But what happens is once the bank closes and then you already have a depressed society because of high unemployment and low median wages, it makes everything further decline. So once the bank isn't there, well, grocery store can't operate because now instead of being able to go to the local branch of the bank to make his deposits and do his business work, the manager now has to drive 10 or 20 miles mm-hmm. to the next closest big city to get it done. And so it increases the cost of operation of those businesses. And so then it further causes...
Yeah, I mean, at that point, you're just into a...
Now, Itabina, I mean, you know, what I don't like about the article is it's just about them. But the, you know, their problem was that their major industry was cotton.
Well,
and so, you know,
again, this world is where they come back to. Yeah. The world marches on, and
exactly.
If you don't.
But what I'm curious about is, okay, we have 6,008 of these, though, across the country where we had branches. And I think it's probably true, for some reason or another, the cost of operating the branch in those areas was too high for what, you know, they probably weren't breaking even. Now, that being said, there are so many banks everywhere. I mean... In the Dayton area, we always talk about Wright-Patterson being the number one employer and healthcare being number two, and then logistics being number three. But in reality, it's probably banking is number three. There are more bank branches. I can go post pictures online of corners where there are at least 4 to 5 banks visible on a single corner.
Well, and again, those typically are... places of more affluence, I would
venture. Yes, guess. They are.
Well, I mean, when you are in that business, you go
where the
money is. I mean, that's not rocket science.
But you know, this concept of deserts, because, I mean, they don't talk about it, but they're essentially a food desert, too. The Dollar Tree is their closest store to buy stuff, which means you're not getting a full-service grocery store. Dollar Trees do sell milk and bread and I think they sell eggs, but everything else they sell is pre-processed frozen food or chips and pop. And
it's not a well-balanced diet.
You're not going to go there and, you know, have a produce section and things like that.
Well, you'll have canned fruits and vegetables, but you won't have.
Do they have canned fruits and vegetables at Dollar Tree? Yeah. I mean, I've only been into one. And
you're not missing much. But the thing is that you're not going to get a fresh produce section. You're not going to get a healthy, well balanced.
Well, you're also not going to get variety of cost either. Like,
well, you know, even
so, it was kind of funny. I was in Kroger's yesterday. So, Kroger's, if you don't know, which is based out of Cincinnati, is actually the largest grocery store chain in the world.
That didn't surprise me.
They own, so if you go out west where you tip, well, actually, I've been to Kroger's as far west as Dallas, Texas, but Kroger's owns Smith's Groceries out west. So you get into California, New Mexico, and Nevada, and a place like that, Smith's is Kroger's. Matter of fact, many, many years ago when I was working out in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, at Kirkland Air Force Base, I went into a Smith's and I was able to use my Kroger card to get Kroger points. So That's how long it's been. And they own through the Midwest, because as you get into Illinois, there's not many Kroger's, my understanding, but they own two or three other grocery store chains too that are common through Illinois and Nebraska and Iowa and Minnesota and all that kind of stuff. So, and that's just in the United States. That's not including the world. Everybody thinks because Walmart is number two, actually, you know, and they're worldwide as well. And you can go into Walmart in Germany, because I've been. But it was funny. Went back, got milk, and there was a young couple in there, and they were complaining about $2.49 a gallon of milk, which it's not the cheapest, but it's not the most expensive I've seen, and it's good quality milk, because I've bought Walmart milk before that you take it home and you could tell it's past its due date, even though it's not marked at its due date. And so this other young lady walks up to him and goes, well, if you want to go up to Moraine, there's a place called Mark's up there where you can get two dozen eggs for 98 cents and a gallon of milk for 98 cents. And I'm glad that Mark's exists. I don't know that I will go partake because of my experiences of buying milk at Walmart, where it is about 50 cents cheaper a gallon. But, you know, it's there. And here's some interesting facts. Although I don't always agree with his preachy way of doing things, but Adam Ruins Everything does occasionally have a good show. Mm-hmm. And he did one about grocery stores and about expiration dates. Even when milk smells bad, you can eat it. It won't make you sick. The smell might make you sick, but it won't. It doesn't turn in such a way that it's going to poison you.
Right.
And, you know, eggs, when you get them at the store, are already 30 days old. And eggs can last refrigerated up to 90 easily. Fresh eggs can be, that are not washed. This is a big issue between the UK and the United States and imports and exports of poultry products. But the FDA requires that all eggs be washed. And I think part of it is just to make them pretty, because, you know, chickens will poop on their own eggs occasionally. In the UK, the law is exactly the opposite. If they're sold in stores, they cannot be washed. But part of the reason is that there is a water-soluble membrane that is excreted when they lay the egg on the outside, and it keeps the egg from going bad while being left out non-refrigerated. So in America, you have to refrigerate your eggs.
Yeah.
In Europe, they leave them on a basket on the counter until they need them. And the only time they wash them is right before they use them.
Well, there you go.
So, you know,
Frigidaire is responsible for that, then, I'm sure. That's likely. They will have greased the palm of the FDA, and now we
wash our eggs.
We wash our eggs. That's part of the process.
But now, so we don't say we never teach you anything. So we're talking about food safety, but. You know, at least there's options to pick from. When you go to a place where your only grocery store is Dollar General.
Yeah, that's
you know, if they say that if they say that a gallon of milk is $3.99, a gallon of milk is $3.99.
So, you know, here's the other thing for me, because it's where I grew up. The East Side is also a food.
Yeah, I haven't been there since...
The last grocery store in the East Side of Dayton had a fire a couple years ago. And it's about the same time as the West Side...
The Kroger's closed up there.
Yeah. There was a fire at an independent grocer on 3rd Street. And that's the only one that I'm aware of that's...
They never talk about the East Side. They always talk about that.
And they wouldn't.
Yeah.
For various other reasons. But it's true.
Yeah. Well, even, you know, you look at a city like Dayton, and with the you have the half beltway, I guess, around the city, or the quarter beltway of 675, but that is about where all the shopping and everything is, because that's where all the affluent communities and the communities who are closest to Wright Pat exist.
Yep. And let's not kid each other. I mean, Wright Pat is the number one employer in the region. There's really that healthcare is number two in the region, has less of an impact, if you ask me.
Mm-hmm.
Because of who the customer is.
True.
And then by having logistics be your number three industry, again, that's exports. I mean, that's stuff leaving Dayton, not necessarily coming in.
Although, oh, exactly.
What I'm getting at is
typically it's not stuff leaving Dayton. It's just because we sit on the crossroads. It's right. Warehoused in Dayton and goes somewhere else. It's not manufactured here.
No. Well, and that's my point.
Yeah.
If Dayton were back to being a base of manufacturing like it used to be, I mean, yep. We were talking about this the other day.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the Gem City was called the Gem City for a reason, and it's not because we like jewelry.
Yep. No, it was because there were more manufacturing businesses in Dayton than anywhere else in the world at the time. Now, you're talking back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and the early 60s, and then after that, it started to transition to China, frankly. Japan first, and then from Japan to China.
Well, and then let's not overlook the death knell, which is GM and NCR leaving.
Well, GM leaving was the worst, because they were actually the number one employer. The only reason Wright Pat is the number one employer is because they're the last man standing. And you're right, NCR leaving, not only did it take away manufacturing jobs, but it also took away a lot of high-tech programming jobs and design jobs.
But let's not also forget that NCR was a homegrown business, too.
It was a Dayton business. Yeah.
You lose that to Georgia, and somehow I think that's just like the city of Dayton waving the white flag of surrender.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
And it's taken a long time to bounce back from that.
It hasn't bounced back yet.
There's pockets. Glimpses of it, and there's, I call them pockets of resistance.
Yeah.
But until something drastic changes, cities like Dayton and Eat a Burrito.
Eat a Bina.
Yeah, whatever. I think I'm not looking at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eat a Burrito.
I don't know.
Maybe that's what you're going to solve both the issues. It will no longer be a food desert, and you're going to start a Mexican restaurant down there.
There you go.
Eat a Burrito and Eat a Bina, Mississippi. I think the reason Eat a Bina, it's funny to me, is because I believe Eat a Bina was mentioned or was part of How Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm now going to have to go back and watch that movie and see where they make the reference, but...
But again, this goes back to innovation and technology. There's room for innovation and technology to solve these kinds of problems. And until someone has the courage to do so, I mean, this involves entrepreneurial spirit.
Yes, it does. Well, and you know, the other question you have to ask yourself is to get this going.
And part two of that is government has to actually help. They have to get out of the way and let entrepreneurs solve problems.
Yeah.
And government doesn't like to do that.
Well, and the other thing that's been interesting to me, and this is kind of related when we talk about entrepreneurial endeavors or entrepreneurship, is there's a lot of entrepreneurship in nonprofit organizations and 503Cs that could come in and help do this with it, you know, where either being a bank or a grocery store would not be considered a loss leader if, you know, they wouldn't close a branch. So, you know, like having a credit union come in, you know, to provide banking, low-cost banking to this community, that would be an entrepreneurial way of doing it. Now, the question is, you know, I don't know what the regulations in Mississippi are for, or the other 6,007.
That's government getting out of the way in order to allow an entrepreneurial solution to a problem that government has mostly caused.
Because the funny thing is if you think about it, I'll use Edelman as an example because we have more information about them to talk about. The bank probably was one of the highest paying
jobs in that area. Yeah.
So if you brought back something like that, you're actually bringing in people who have money to buy things, and so that it raises the bar for all the businesses and everything else there.
Now,
And it provides an opportunity for people to then either acquire the education or through experience work their way up through the system.
Right. Well, and that's, this is where I come back and will expose my political bias for a moment and say you're a member of Congress from New York who's relatively young and your head is full of socialism is awesome. You would recommend that...
Hey, isn't that in the Lego movie?
I'm sure it is. Your solution would be, well, let's pay everybody $15 an hour and let's have everything be free.
Yeah.
Again, this is government that's not helping.
Exactly.
Until you have a system where there's value being added and created, this town is not gonna bounce back.
Yeah. Well, I agree. I totally agree. So what's interesting is going back to, we were talking about, you know, nonprofits who are providing, let me find it here on my laptop.
You don't have these things all queued up?
Well, this one was one that came up from Slashdot today.
Gotcha.
So there is a 503C organization in New York City who is providing broadband internet access and providing more value than everybody else. And part of that is because government regulation has come in and made internet access, they're treating it like they're letting the internet access companies, because they're building infrastructure, act like they're utilities, but not treating them like utilities. And so, you know, in the United States, that's one of the big complaints, is that we have these weird let me find the Slashdot article, but you know, internet access is all over the place. There's issues with rural internet access. There's issues with urban internet access, you know, and depending on where you are, there's these wide swings in cost, because the cost to operate varies so much. But part of that cost to operate varies is because it's, you know, these companies don't innovate to think about, well, what's an alternative way to do this? But basically, it's a community-run operation named NYC Mesh, and their mission is to deliver better, cheaper broadband service to New York City. They are a locally run nonprofit, and then they're actually going to do an expansion that should deliver more bandwidth to more boroughs in Manhattan and Brooklyn. And basically they're doing it with a wireless thing. You buy for $110, you buy the router and a rooftop antenna, and there's a $50 installation fee. So for $160, it is funded by optional monthly donations of $20 to $50 for residential users or $100 for business. Optional. But they found another way, an innovative way, to deliver this much cheaper than the folks that are there and much more reliably. And they're not the only one. There's a company called Starry. Now, they're a commercial company. They're not a non-profit. Who's moving into the Dayton area. They're moving to like 100 new markets. They're moving to Dayton, Cincinnati, Columbus, Indianapolis, I think Louisville and Lexington. Those are the ones local to us. But they were mainly East Coast, and they're the same thing. Particularly in urban areas, they put out a big wireless antenna, and then they deliver broadband to an entire building or multiple buildings. And, you know, the other thing, that there's no caps on how much bandwidth you can use. There's no, you know, nothing that you're getting from these standard IPs like Comcast and things like, or IPs, ISPs. Yeah, they're all internet protocol addresses. But, you know, and the funny thing is they've been around since 2013. So it's not like, but this is the kind of innovation you want to see, particularly in...
Well, that's...
Because I've even thought about that, the Starry model, but do it on more like a co-op type system. You know, we get decent broadband from Spectrum out in the country where I live. I mean, but why can't I get Verizon? I mean, it's not like they're burying this underground. All of our stuff runs on poles along the road. Most of Southern Ohio is that way, even in Cincinnati and Dayton.
Yeah.
And why don't we get better service than we do? And why can't Verizon come in and compete with Spectrum and AT&T? Because Indianapolis has Verizon, you know.
Well, this is where I come back and say, this is...
Why is the government allowed to...
Yeah, government has been making those choices for you.
Yeah.
And if it's not at the state level, it's at the local level. Somebody has made that decision for you.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say that these companies aren't benefiting from it, because they are. They're being allowed to essentially have a monopoly without having a monopoly.
Yeah. They have a monopoly because of regulation, not because they're actually in a monopoly.
But it's still to their advantage.
So yes, it
is. They're not gonna oppose it.
Well, that's always been the issue with cable, and you know, you complain, and they go, "Well, but you can get satellite." And it's like,
yeah, I could, but then I could stick a hot poker in my eye. But,
and I think that's where people have gotten to the point, and why you have so many cord cutters.
Yeah.
And you know, the other thing is ISPs are cable companies are slowly realizing that they're ISPs. You look at Spectrum in our area, which, you know, we were Time Warner, and we're part of the area that Charter purchased, so we become Charter Spectrum. But they're starting to sell cellular phone service.
Yeah.
Now, what I'm curious about that, not that I'm going to switch from Verizon, who's been excellent worldwide for me, who are they, a mobile virtual network operator, MVNO, it's kind of hard to say. Should have drank all that bourbon at lunch. But because that's who, you know, if you are an MVNO, you're leasing somebody else's infrastructure to actually become like everybody, you know, Cricket Wireless is an MVNO of Sprint, and Walmart's FreeTalk is an MVNO of AT&T. So you're... And, you know, my uncle used to work for AT&T. Well, he actually worked for Bell Labs and AT&T. And, he, you know, back in the 80s when we had a... Oh, who were the long-distance phone people that, you know, that started popping out? they were essentially the same thing. They were operating mobile virtual networks for long distance. But what you would get is, yeah, you'd get these super cheap rates compared to like AT&T, but AT&T was regulating you down to their poorest circuits.
Yeah.
And that's why you'd call on them and, you know, and yeah, you saved a whole bunch of money, but you heard all this hiss on the other end, and sometimes the phone line would drop and everything else, you know. So it's not...
you get what you pay for.
Exactly.
I mean, you always have, always will. I mean, that again goes back to the basic fundamental thing about economics. If something has a value, it has a value.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, that's... And I hate to say it, but everything will always have a value.
To segue off of that,
yeah,
that's why I don't think... So that's why I don't think most government people worldwide, most politicos, don't understand virtual currency or cryptocurrency, because the value in cryptocurrency is the privacy, is the distributed nature of the network, so that if a bank, you know, if a node goes offline, which is essentially a bank, you don't lose anything. You know, all these things that are valuable exist, so they don't understand what the value is, because it's intangible, and, you know, I can't put it in my hand. They think because it's a dollar bill or a franc or a pound sterling, I can slap it in my hand and it has value. Sterling coin does. A pound sterling piece
exactly.
of paper is a virtual
yeah.
construct.
It's every bit as cryptocurrency as cryptocurrency.
You got it.
And that's, you know, so long as it's not backed by something tangible.
Yeah.
I mean, our money used to be backed
by
gold.
Gold, yes. Well, and our
and
coin
then it had
value. Exactly. When we
now
went off the
doesn't.
Gold and silver standards, you know, and all currency worldwide did, currency does not, it only has value because we say it has value, not because it actually has value.
And that's why consumer confidence matters so much.
Yes.
It's what's propping up the U.S. dollar and really currency
across
the world.
Yep.
So, I mean, that's why when you have stock market crashes, everyone loses their mind.
Right. Yep.
You know, it's... You could wind up being like, you know, the Weimar Republic, and you have wheelbarrows full of cash that
are worthless.
Are worthless. I mean, we're seeing that play out in Venezuela right now.
I have a stack of Weimar Republic Deutschmarks.
Yeah, I mean, you get the point, though.
Yeah, no, I totally get it. You look at it, and I got a stack about that big, and I'm like, rich! I was a little kid. It was with my coin collection, and I'm like, I'm rich! And then I found out that they're worthless. It's paper. The value, they only have value because of historical value, not because they're backed by anything. So, we'll leave it there. We don't have any answers for this. I mean, it's complex and...
No, I think we do have
answers. Well, we do have answers.
One, government has to get out of the way and allow an entrepreneurial and innovative spirit come in and do what needs to be done.
Yeah.
That's and two, when you're in a situation where you're in a municipality that is dying, look at why it's dying. If it's a manufacturing base that's no longer manufacturing anything, here's your first clue. It's time to move. And if you can't move because you waited too long, now you're in real trouble.
Yeah. Well, and I think a lot of these small towns and things that, you know, were agricultural and particularly like cotton, which is, it's not a truck crop, meaning it's not a crop that people eat. I mean, farmers who produce food in the United States make money.
Well, yeah, because not only do they make money off what product they grow and sell, but then
they get
subsidies
yeah.
too. So, I mean, it's...
But,
although that's not really affecting your family farm. It's corporate farms that are getting the bulk of the subsidies.
Correct.
That's another whole argument.
Correct. But, you know, leadership in towns like that, you know, the local government, where they can be useful and where they should be in the way is if they recognize that, hey, we can't do what we used to do. They need to be part of the solution to go find what can come next. Otherwise, it's like anything. Let the town die. I mean, I hate to say it, change is scary, but change has to happen, and it's inevitable. Think about climate change.
And again, this is about creative destruction. You can't build something new
without destroying the old.
Yeah. And particularly when you're talking about systems as complex as a town.
Yeah.
It's fragile to begin with. And unless you have a governmental system that erodes your personal liberties and freedoms and rights, there's no government coming to save you.
Exactly.
You have to do what you have to do.
But that's the whole point of local rule and everything else too, is, you know, those people are.
But then you gotta hope that local rule is, one, competent, and two.
Well, that's what I mean.
You know, has the ability to do what's necessary, even if what's necessary is nothing at all.
Very true. Very true. So, I want to segue into the last topic. This actually came up today in the news feed. But the this group created something called DeepNude, and it's a computer program that uses neural networks, so it's machine learning and AI, to transform an image of a clothed woman into a realistic rendering of what she would look like naked. Now, the reason the people who developed this, they did it because they're working on neural networks. And their excuse for making it women was because there's a lot of nude pictures of women on the internet. So there was a large, sample of data that would allow them to then create these renderings. They said that if you feed a male picture in, it shows a naked man, but with female genitalia. Because there's just not as much male nudity on the internet, I guess. I think that's kind of weird. But they posted it as like a website, just, you know, for people to see, to demonstrate the technology. But they got 500,000 hits in a day. And so it also, what it outputs would be was watermarked, so that, you know, supposedly people wouldn't be able to use it for nefarious purposes. But they ended up having to take it down because of the fact that it could be used for nefarious purposes.
Well, as if it wasn't a nefarious purpose in the first place.
When you called it deep nude.
Yeah, come on now.
But I think it's humorous. But I liken it out there to, again, I think I said this once today, if not on the last podcast. Morality is always 50 years behind technology. And so these guys created something that's actually very cool technology, but their application of it is poor.
Well, I mean... How many technologies have started with pornography as being the...
Well, heck, that's what drove the internet.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Not only the internet, but go back cameras and... I mean, all along, it's shameful, but not unexpected in this case.
Yes. Yeah. And, but, you know, it would have been probably easier, in my opinion, for them to have created one that did the reverse. It would take a nude picture and you could clothe somebody Or you could take any picture and you could recreate them in different outfits. So you get a realistic rendering of what this would look like. That's a practical application. And it's not too far off of what they were doing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, this was somebody who was like, oh, here's a neat idea. How do we monetize that long term?
Yeah.
Let's not kid each other. That's what was going on there.
Yeah. I want my picture of so and so, you know, nude. I would have said like Bella Thorne, but then all of her nudes are already out there, so
I got nothing for that.
Not that I have gone and looked. It's just I read the article where she was hacked and they threatened to put her nudes out, so she just posted them to take her power back. There's a whole discussion about that kind of attitude that I have. I mean, I totally understand wanting to thwart the hacker. I'm not going to get into it because that's a total discussion Matt and I need to have offline before we talk about it on the show. So,
but you brought this up.
I wish Sean were here to talk about it. We'll talk about this again with Sean and go, hey, Sean, did you use that? We want to hear from you, our listeners, so please send us any kind of feedback to gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. And we'll see you on the digital flip side.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.